Welcome back to Left Anchor. I'm Ryan Cooper. Today on the podcast, we have returning guest Brad Evans to talk about his book, How Black Was My Valley? Poverty and Abandonment in a Post-Industrial Heartland. Brad grew up in Wales in the Rust Belt, basically, of the UK, and has an interesting sort of biographical exploration of that region. And so we discuss that, the history of the UK, the some comparisons with the United States, but, you know, just more broadly, why coal appears to be so bad for the long-term development of, you know, particular coal-bearing regions and, you know, what that means for society writ large. But anyway, let's not waste any more time. Let's get to our interview with Brad Evans right now. So, Brad Evans, welcome back to the program. Your book, again, is called How Black Was My Valley? Poverty and Abandonment in a Post-Industrial Heartland. And I thought it would be, you know, a sensible place to start out by asking you, you know, where do you come from, you know, in Wales? I imagine the typical American is probably not that clear on whether Wales is different from England or like a subunit of England.
Yeah. I think for most people out of the United Kingdom, to be honest with you, Wales is no different to England in a strange way. You know, aside from the fact that we've kind of made a few inroads in football lately internationally. So because we've actually made a few international tournaments, we now have the recognition of being a nation in our own right. So I'm from this, you know, this area of South Wales, which is called the Rhondda Valleys. Now, it's interesting. And actually, maybe I can talk briefly about this in a sense of when I was growing up, actually, I grew up in, you know, conditions of poverty in this place called the Rhondda Valleys. And when I went to university, I kind of went to great lengths to tell people I actually wasn't from this place, right, because the place is so associated with poverty and so on. Having avoided all this kind of, you know, placement of myself, much to my utter surprise, that when I eventually told people I was from this place, nobody had the faintest idea where on earth this place actually was, right? So, but I've since learned that that in itself is quite a remarkable and actually a troubling proposition, because historically, if you look at the Rhondda Valleys of South Wales, it's an old mining community. It's largely based on mines, but also it was also very much part of the Industrial Revolution, and the big kind of iron and steel works were based there as well. Now, you can't write a history of globalization without accounting for the South Wales valleys. And in that sense, you know, to give you a sense very quickly, the very first time in history the red flag of socialism was flown was in 1831 in the South Wales Valleys in a place called Merthyr Tydfil. It's also the very start point of the British Labour Party, which is born in this very small area of the United Kingdom. The impetus for what we call the National Health Service in the UK begins in the South Wales Valleys. Most of the steel that's laid to for the US railroads was actually produced in Merthyr Tydfil and exported over for the journey westwards. So it's this community which is at the heart of the history of empire, socialism, you know, struggle for the solidarity of rights of miners and working communities around the world, and yet literally falls off the map today. And that to me is quite an interesting thing in itself.
So, you know, we're looking at a classic sort of worst case scenario for post-industrial, you know, sort of economic and social, you know, collapse and dislocation. Americans should, you know, you could pretty much film it. But in fact, I want to talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, before we get to that, it's sort of a memoir of sorts. You know, you bring in a lot of other stuff, but you're talking about your own life here. And, you know, one thing that was interesting to me is that you're in this area, but you are not, your family was not formally, you know, working class, if I remember correctly, in that, you know, your father had a disability. And so you're basically surviving off of the incredibly meager, you know, welfare benefits to keep people who couldn't work, you know, and their families alive. So can you tell us a little bit about what that was like and what you saw, you know, growing up?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, It's a bit of a cliche that people say when you live in a community where everybody's poor, you don't know poverty, which is utter nonsense, right? You're very acutely aware of poverty. And even the very small kind of indications of poverty is not a level playing field. There's degrees of poverty within, and simple things like the purchase of football boots and so on, you know, that become very clear, identifiable markers of one's own poverty. Now, for me, you know, growing up, it's, and I say a lot of this in the book, you know, I feel like if you grow up in these poor communities, you're very much like a walk-in contradiction, you know, because for me, on the one hand, if I look back to childhood, I've got lots of great memories of me and my mates actually playing around in the discarded coal mines, you know, and getting up to mischief, you know, utterly kind of dangerous. And I'd be horrified if you thought of your own children doing this today, you know, but that's what we would do as kids, you know, and it was great fun and great adventure. But also you're acutely aware and you see the struggle and the difficulties. And in terms of my own family, as you said, you know, so my parents were 18 when I was born. 2 years later, my father was diagnosed with a lifelong medical condition. So basically we lived totally reliant on state benefits. And you see the, first of all, the utter wretchedness of families who have to, at close hand, who have to live on, you know, a dependency economy. And a dependency economy, which also is there at the moment the Thatcherism arrives, and this whole kind of process of, you know, really trying to make ends meet. And I mean, literally trying to make ends meet, you know, on a daily basis rather than just a monthly basis. You know, how do we survive another day? And how do we take, you know, the next indication that the state is going to reduce more benefits? And even in that sense, you know, we're seeing parents with an inability to work. But also you see in the narrative which surrounds this, well, you know, people on welfare are just lazy families and so on, you know, and trying to kind of make sense of that politics was, when you see it firsthand, it gives you, I guess, an acute insight into the psychosis of those kinds of conditions and the ways in which actually it internalizes within you a kind of shame of being poor. And I think how you navigate that is very difficult, I think.
Right. And it strikes me, Brad, that there's so many things you disabuse people of regarding poverty. And you just said one of those things, that you don't know you're poor, but, the Thatcher arrival and the statement that there is no society is in stark contrast to what even the kind of broken community and broken people under these dire circumstances were able to do for one another. You even talk about how there was, you know, a young boy whose mother, was an alcoholic and kind of not there at all. And he would just go from place to place and whoever was there would feed him and kind of take care of him. And he even had a little bit of joy despite these kind of circumstances. But like, as much as we don't want to kind of, romanticize poverty, and we'll get into, I think I've long admired your resistance to the resilience narrative, that neoliberalism tries to indoctrinate. But there is an amazing kind of, beauty of the human spirit in the communal coming together to help survive, right?
Yeah. And I think this is part of, you know, the experience of the valleys historically. There was always a real kind of strong sense of solidarity and community historically. Now, I don't want to over-romanticize that because that is also kind of problematic on some occasions, you know, but I talk a lot in the book about, you know, the need to remember the ways in which communities did support each other through very difficult times. And as you say, it did manifest itself in everyday forms of kindness and everyday forms of kindness. And this is my experience the world over, you know, poor communities tend to be the most giving sometimes, you know, and I even talk about in the book this remarkable experience where, and it's such a wonderful memory I have of a load of us. We must have been, I think, about 7 years old. We would have been actually 10 years old, sorry. And we went on this kind of sponsored walk to raise money for the starving children of Ethiopia, right? And we're all utterly disheveled, malnourished kids ourselves, knocking on doors trying to get sponsorship for starving children in Africa. And we actually raised a lot of money relatively to what we would even, you know, had ourselves. And I think there's just little gestures like that, which I think is still there in poor communities, you know, and there's little moments that makes you realize regardless of the weight of history and the ways in which people can be, you know, downtrodden and the stereotypes we place on them, that it, that is just simple, you know, something remarkable in the basic human decency of people. And I think those simple kind gestures to me speak so much more sometimes than big organized rallies supporting people, you know. And I think there's we need to find those little moments in life, which I think reaffirm that people actually will resist, but in sometimes, you know, very everyday ways that they will just reveal their basic humanism to one another, which I think is very important to remind ourselves of from time to time.
Yeah, I want to get back into, you know, this question of employment. But as I said before, you know, this discussion of Wales, South Wales, led me to look up a few statistics on United States coal country. And, you know, I looked up the list of the, as of 2022, at least, poorest counties in the United States. And the very poorest one is in West Virginia. It's called McDowell County. It's the setting of the film October Sky, if you've ever seen that. Homer Hickam, the guy who becomes a rocket engineer from being a, you know, son of a coal miner. But compared to, you know, that film set in the 1950s, I believe. Compared to 1950, the population of that county has fallen by 80%, more than 80%. The household income is $29,000 as compared to the United States average of $75,000. Life expectancy is about 23.5 years for men and 71.5 years for women as compared to the average of 76.5 years for men and 81.2 years for women, which itself is quite low by international standards, like 5, 6, 7 years below, you know, Japan and Norway and whatnot. Highest drug-induced death rate of any county in the country, 141 per 100,000 in 2022 as compared to 14.7 per 100,000 population across the whole country, which again is very, very high relative to international standards. So I guess, you know, my first question here is, you know, why is coal specifically so bad? It seems like across every country where you have, you know, the very most coal dependent, counties and regions in, you know, 1940, 1950, 1960-ish are now just absolute hulks, you know, shells of themselves, where people, you know, literally just dying and killing themselves with abuse and suicide and whatnot. What is it about coal?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's a really good, interesting question, Ryan. You know, I think, first of all, I think there's something about coal itself, which we know that there's a kind of ancient reverence to coal, actually, but there's a kind of, there's a darkness to the coal, literally, right? And I think there's a bleakness to the rock that, that on the one hand really binds communities to the, where coal takes root and people start mining it. You know, it creates a sense of rootedness for people in those communities, which then creates a kind of, I don't know, a bizarre kind of psychosis where once the coal is extracted and the brutal extraction of getting the coal out from the ground itself takes its toll on a population, not just who have to extract it, but well into the future. We know the way it scars landscapes, it scars ecologies. And I think it's very similar. All those statistics you talk about, you know, are mirrored in the South Wales Valleys, right? So it's almost like you're holding up a mirror to one another in this real kind of, almost like a black mirror to one another. And I think there is something then deeply tragic about, you know, so in like I talk about in the book, you know, in a chapter called 100 Years of Depression, you know, from the late 1920s onwards, where there was the appreciation that the coal is actually starting to decline in the Welsh Valleys in 1924, actually, you know, so there's a long kind of decline of the industry. And we could talk maybe a bit more about the reasons for that in a bit. But there's, it's clear that from that moment onward, there's, anybody who can leave the valley will leave the valley, right? So we talk about brain drains and skill drains and all this kind of narrative. When I was growing up, it was drummed into you, if you're going to be successful, you leave the valley, you know? And I think what that means then is the people who stay, it's almost like a populated ghost town. And I think that's the way I would describe it. You know, the people are kind of stuck in these landscapes and in these zones where they are absolutely bound to a place, which is, and as you say, then it reveals all the worst of all the social ailments, right? And, but interestingly also, you know, I'm not sure whether it's the case in terms of like the ill health you were talking about in terms of, you know, the US situation. But certainly, for instance, in the South Wales valleys, you know, when the mines were open, overwhelmingly the biggest killer was pneumoconiosis, which was the black lung disease, which basically killed so many, you know, miners and so on. The biggest killer in the South Wales valleys today is heart disease. Because the very look of poverty in itself has changed. It's no longer emaciation, but it's linked to bad diets and heart disease. So it's an entirely different economy, which again is based on a stasis and a staticness and a rootedness of people that keeps them, you know, trapped. And within the valleys in South Wales as well, it is a valley, and you are literally geographically kind of stuck as well, you know.
Yeah, the same is true in West Virginia. You know, these are the hollers, as they say. It's I mean, people, well, they can and do leave or die, you know, as the population figures show. But
yeah,
it does seem, to whatever reason, you know, you can point to like commodity. If you're like put on your economist hat, and you could point to like commodity extraction communities that tend to be like this all the time because it's boom and bust. You know, I remember you went to county in Utah, it was very oil dependent, and you would go from 5% unemployment to 15% unemployment in like 1 year, just depending on the price of oil. But it didn't bite in the same way. It's not that, it's not the very poorest county in the entire country. And
but I think there's also something about coal extraction, which in itself from the beginning, you know, it's not like people who work in the mines ever made a load of money, right? So it already attracts deeply precarious populations in the first place who have to work in those conditions. And I'm also interested in the kind of the tragedy of the geology and the geological history of this. You know, there's this wonderful interview with Richard Burton on the Dick Cavett Show, and he talks about his father as a miner. But he also, you know, talks about the what was called the Transatlantic Seam, which was basically the coal face, which starts in the Basque Country, then goes across to the South Wales valleys, goes under the Atlantic Ocean, and it literally comes up in Appalachia. And it's so basically the miners were cutting in Appalachia and cutting in the South Wales valleys could tell exactly the same seam of coal, and they would identify it. And there's a real kind of dark tragedy which is seeping across the globe in terms of, you know, literally, you know, as a one giant rock formation, which is in itself, I think, is very kind of powerful symbolically and tragic when you think about it in terms of this, you know, dark encrust beneath the Earth's surface.
And you write in a way that this is the location of the start of the Anthropocene, right? It's you can kind of see the beginning. I guess some people differentiate prehistory from history this way, that, but this is where natural disasters kind of turn into human made disasters. And it's your ecology of suffering you discuss is not just the people who live there, but also it's seen in the aesthetic of the place itself that we've inserted our humanity into in a certain way, right?
Yeah. Well, in terms of the Anthropocene, you know, I deal with this in a chapter for me, which was by far the most difficult thing I've ever had to write, which was a chapter on the disaster in Abovan. And for the listeners who don't know the Abovan disaster, you know, it occurs in 1966, where basically one of the unique things about the Welsh valleys is literally the mountainous valleys. So what made them unique was the fact in which when the coal was extracted and there was the slag waste, they literally piled on the side of the mountains, right? This obviously eventually, when you're in a landscape which rains a lot, you tend to get lots of landslides. And on this one occasion, the landslides and basically wipes out, you know, half a community's children in a school. And this event happens in 1966. And it's hard, I think, to really capture what the impact of Abovan had on the psychology of the valleys. But what I try to do in the book is also say, well, okay, what does this event really mean today? And how do we understand, you know, and it's clear in the valleys, it leads to a great deal of political apathy, a great deal of the people who are meant to protect the community never protected the community. But also, you know, for me, it's the very first time, this was actually regarded as the very first disaster globally, which had running 24-hour media news coverage. So it was the first one, there was journalists sent to do live reports from Abovan. And this was seen as a real moment in kind of disaster media coverage. But also it's the very first time really where you have a public tribunal which asks the question, is there such a thing as a natural disaster? And I think while, of course, the official narrative came out of it, which was still pretty much, well, yeah, it's a natural disaster, then there's lots of rainfall and so on. To raise that question, as you say, raises the question of the Anthropocene. that we humans are responsible for ecological catastrophes. And I think that was a real pivotal moment looking back in terms of that moment, yeah.
And you were born not too long after that, right?
Yeah, well, I was the generation which basically filled the schools after Aberfan, right? So I was born in 1974. And it's quite interesting in terms of, you know, when I was born in 1974, there was a letter sent to the Secretary of State for Wales, which basically, as part of this official document, it declared the South Wales valleys are dying, right? So it's kind of an irony being born in a year which the place you were born is dying. And I think that in itself, you know, but Aberfan, I think, you know, because I think there's something deeply symbolic about the death of so many children. You know, and you think about, you know, the death of children at the hands of something which their parents were doing, right? They were the miners and they were the ones who were putting this stuff on the mountainside. And I think that death of children always points to the future. And I think to me, you know, it does represent the death of the prospects of the future of so many children in that landscape. So, yeah.
Death of natality in a way, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Can you, in that context, can you talk a little bit about, you know, Thatcherism and the experience of Thatcherism, you know, sort of being a coming after, you know, as you were sort of entering, you know, late childhood, you know, or, you know, mid-late childhood, this sort of acceleration, you know, it's like these communities that, as you say, have been floundering at this point for like 50 years or longer, mm-hmm. and then just being, you know, basically thrown into the sea mm-hmm. from London. But what yeah. was that like?
Well, you know, I think it's worth reminding, first of all, that, you know, Thatcher wasn't the start of the closure of the mining industries. You know, a lot of that was happening long before her. But she became almost like, you know, the real bad messenger because she's accelerated it, but she puts the final nail in the coffin. But also it's the doing it unapologetically and doing it in a way which basically says, you know, this way of life is not sustainable. That's just destroy it, but disregard the populations who are still living there, right? So in that sense, there was a, you know, a clear moment with her. Now with Thatcher, I think it's interesting in the sense of thinking about, first of all, okay, you have this population, you basically say we're going to destroy everything this population stands for, particularly state socialism, trade unionism, all this kind of aspect, which were rooted very much in the history of the South Wales valleys. And almost in a very kind of vindictive way, say, for those communities, there's nothing going to replace it. And we're not going to give you welfare benefits. We're not going to give you, you know, very meager state support. So in that sense, you know, and these communities are the traditional communities that voted the Labour Party. So why would you give these communities any support anyway? But I think the bigger shift with Thatcherism was, as we know, the rampant materialization of everything. And through that Thatcher period, you become more and more aware of your poverty. You become more and more aware because suddenly the world becomes this glitzy, glamorous place of, you know, of yuppie culture, of commodification, of buying all these, you know, 80-pound trainers. And, you know, I'm not saying Thatcher's the only person to blame for this because this is a stage of capitalist development, but she really accelerates in the United Kingdom. So growing up in that period, you became more and more acutely aware of the things you never had. And I think that becomes very manifest in that particular moment.
It just strikes me as that elites in the US and I think to a lesser extent, the UK, I'm not sure if the Labour Party is quite on board with this sort of thing, but, you know, I'm put in mind of, Thatcher going on this experiment that's basically like classical 19th century liberalism. That's just like free trade, you know, and just like if we have to flush South Wales into the ocean, that's fine. That's, you know, that's what the market says. The market says you are worthless and you should die. And then, you know, 40 years later, there's a lot of thought in like Washington DC and the whole Biden administration. And they're like, oh no, that was really bad. We should like try to create a manufacturing renaissance. We should try to like, you know, make sure that these jobs that we're creating for green energy and green manufacturing and so on go into the communities that have been sort of left behind a little bit too late in many circumstances. They kind of don't exist anymore. It just reminds me of, Eric Hobsbawm's joke that, if it could be shown by, you know, economists that the whole of the world's industrial production should be put into a small corner of like Madagascar, as like 80% of watches were made in Switzerland for a time, then there is no argument in liberalism to against doing it. It would just be like, okay, the whole world now doesn't have any reason to live. Do you find any hope in this sort of bleary perception that some of this neoliberalism was a terrible mistake?
Well, I think it's an absolutely terrible mistake. But in a sense, I think that, you know, there's a danger I think we always need to avoid in terms of not having a nostalgia for the coal, because we know the coal itself is, you know, and I think there can be too much of a romanticism around that. You know, let's be clear, working in a coal mine was a bleak, horrible existence. I think it was everything that was linked to that, which was the destruction. You know, it was the miners' institutes. It was all the chapels. It was all, the social fabric of a society, which utterly gets destroyed, which was linked to one particular mode of production. Now, in terms of, you know, I think we can have these economic measures around, you know, the impacts of neoliberalism. But I think, you know, what I'm also interested in is the kind of the embodied ways in which poverty and the disaster of neoliberalism, which I also don't think is inseparable from the start point of the crisis of white male subjectivity too, starts to take place there and takes root there. And to give you maybe an example here that, again, in the early 1980s, you know, so you have this economy which is largely dependent primarily on heavy labor, heavy kind of, you know, material production. And that gives rise to, you know, the figure of the miner, right? The miner has a very particular look and an aesthetic. But what you find during the 1980s, you know, is, so you have these communities, and there was one other kind of, you know, smaller manufacturing bases where, for instance, there was a local factory called the EMI factory, which was also involved in terms of arms production, but then they started producing the ferric oxide tapes for a while for the EMI and so on. Now this eventually closes down as well because of the whims of globalization, because none of these organizations can compete anyway in the global market. And in the 1980s, you start to realize, you know, that I walk around this kind of these factories, which are, you know, I guess similar to what you might have in Detroit and so on, you know, these kind of really old, kind of broken down post-industrial kind of places. And they're always populated by enhanced steroid using men who have their equally over enhanced dogs, where they're walking around, which are part of this kind of de-emasculated subject who's now trying to replace heavy manual labor with heavy lifting, but they're basically unemployed. So
don't forget the huge trucks. There are massive trucks also.
They use anabolic steroids, and they're obscenely large. And alongside that, then you have the emergence of the heroin subject, right? So the opioid epidemic starts hitting the valleys. And it's kind of this bizarre situation where you're walking through these landscapes. And, you know, I go to school with all these kids, right? So you know them and you're never threatened by them. But you see them and it's kind of almost like this dystopic landscape of these, you know, large guys against the emaciated figures. And somewhere in there is the crisis of white male subjectivity, right? There's something in between that space that's deeply tragic. And the tragedy of both of them end up dying prematurely from excruciating organ failure as well, you know. So there's something really horrific, I think, in that. The way poverty starts.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, yeah. It almost, the way you describe it to me, maybe this is off base, but it almost seemed like between sadism and masochism, you have an outward directed kind of anger and insecurity that manifests in bullying and the various, toxic masculine forms. And then there's the kind of inward escaping into the pain of the self or numbing the self and in a kind of at least subconsciously masochistic way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting as well, because, you know, as you said, that sense in which on the one hand, there's the person who really wants to be seen. So they make themselves obscenely large, right? And then, and we used to know, like, you started hearing stories in the 1980s of the kids we used to call the druggies, but you never saw them. You know, they kept themselves in the shadows, you know, and there this kind of, you know, well, they kind of blended in with the grayness of the building, right? So there was, there was a strange ecology to that as well, which is deeply tragic as well, you know. And I've seen friends go that way, you know, which again is a real tragedy, you know.
On that question of the white male subjectivity, you mentioned the story of Richard Burton's brother, right? And I thought it was quite telling how he said that everybody got out except for his oldest brother, if I remember correctly. And his oldest brother just loved being a coal miner. And in fact, I mentioned the movie October Sky before, but there's a similar character in Jake Gyllenhaal's character's father, played by Chris Cooper, who's a coal miner, and he really is proud of being a coal miner. This is a line at one point. I've seen this movie because of like 50 times because of one particular Spanish teacher who would always put it on when he wasn't in class. Anyway, he says, you know, if coal fails, steel fails. And if steel fails, this country fails. And he's down there, you know, like rescuing guys from a, you know, fallen in shaft. And he's, I'm not afraid of a little coal dust. And it strikes me like how this, you know, the employment and the risk and the heavy work that went into mining coal was such a powerful creator of identity, while at the same time being horribly dangerous and poisonous and giving you black lung. And Homer Hickam's dad did die of black lung later in his life. And yeah, I don't know. I guess speak to how this, like, simultaneously, it was like a sort of keystone like institution, the male identity of the coal miner, the strength, how that was a sort of like prop of society, while also being toxic, while also when it was kicked away without anything to replace it, that was almost kind of the worst of all possible worlds, it seems to me.
Yeah, but it's interesting because you say, first of all, that, you know, the coal is literally toxic.
Yeah.
It has this, you know, that's a literally toxicity to it. Now, I think, you know, with the miners, when I look back, you know, the miners' stories and you see the testimonies of the miners, the one thing that comes up very clearly, as you say, is an absolute pride and dignity in their work, you know. And you see there was a great deal of resistance in the South Wales valleys when they started to bring in more high-tech machinery, because the miners thought that you were robbing them of their skill. That they felt they were skilled workers and they could identify the rock face and where to cut it. And, you know, and the more automated it became, which was done in the name of safety, they hated it, right? Because they felt that you had actually taken away the skill of being a miner, and almost like the risk was part of the skill to know, you know, if you cut into the rock and it didn't collapse on you, yes, you're a good miner, right? So there is that kind of, you know, and it's perverse to think about it. But of course, we know lots of jobs involve risk and people like to say, well, you know, I can do this and I excel. What's interesting also about the valleys, you know, and I do think this is, you know, a very important conversation in terms of how we navigate contemporary identity politics around masculinity. And I think what I've learned from looking at the, you know, especially from the testimonies of the miners, masculinity is not a single thing, right? And we need to have a much more of a, you know, a complex understanding of, you know, and indeed I talk about this in terms of the logics of pride as well. You know, we know pride can be so easily appropriated and turned to negative ends, but sometimes a little bit of pride in your work is not a bad thing, you know. And I think that and certain aspects of masculinity, I look back on the miners now and what some of them were just genuinely good people who did remarkable things for their communities. And actually, if you look at the, you know, in the South Wales valleys, actually, the growth in domestic abuse and domestic violence happens post-mining. You know, it is this kind of, you know, there's a shift actually where the toxicity really seeps out. Where, and I'm not saying those societies weren't, you know, patriarchal and there weren't a lot of problems with them, but you see the explosion in domestic abuse and violence happens post-mining. And I think that there is, and to give another example, you know, of this, that you heard the story recently of like the steelworks in Port Talbot in South Wales, which is, you know, just been announced that Tata Steel are closing this steelworks. And it's basically, it is the final nail in the coffin of South Wales industry. So this is on the end of one of the mining communities as well. No sooner have they announced that the steelworks are closing, there's already a spike in domestic violence in this town. And I think, you know, to me, that is, it may not necessarily be the violence of masculinity in itself, but the violence of a certain vulnerability linked to masculinity, I think, which becomes more prevalent in these communities, I think.
Yeah, it sort of seems to me that, you know, in a capitalist society where it's been drilled into you your whole life that, like, your social worth comes from your job and you compensate for the objective shittiness of your job, the danger and the, you know, poison by, you know, taking pride in the fact that you're doing a difficult job that nobody else wants to do. And then that's taken away without any attempt at all to replace it with anything. No, not even, not so much as a retraining, you know, go work some other job and pin your life on that. It's just like, you know, good luck. Then I think that's when you get the most distorted and awful forms of people who are basically sad. You know, it's like without that, you know, that sense of self-worth, they feel, you know, depressed. And you know, men are not, as a rule, taught how to deal with those sort of, you know, that's like girly emotions. You're supposed to suppress that. You're not supposed to feel sad. And so instead it comes out sideways as anger, and you take out your anger on your wife and your kids. And yeah, you see this is the same type of thing in, you know, McDowell County, as I was saying, that, you know, rates of domestic abuse, child abuse are extremely high. You know, you see the same thing in, disinvested, you know, Black communities, Native American communities, high rates of drug abuse, and so on. And yeah, yeah, you.
Well, no, it just strikes me too. You know, these themes of non-recognition, of abandonment, of being forgotten, and of having certain cultural formations that don't give people, don't inspire the imagination of how to find an identity that doesn't result in a kind of toxic masculinity, or that allows you to deal with vulnerability. Like, there are some interesting stories you tell though about, you know, some of these men dressing up like women. And so, I mean, there isn't a lack of creativity and playfulness and all that, but like you know, these were heroes who literally helped the war efforts, and yet there were no statues of them. This was a place, as you say, that drove empire and drove all these monumental things that so many people benefited from, and yet they were forgotten and unrecognized. And yet today, why is it important to remember these places, these people? And how does that relate to so many contemporary, I would suggest, illnesses that lead to far right faux populism, MAGA, and all this stuff, right? There's some kind of connection there, because they see in the reaching out from a Trump a kind of new way to be that gives them somewhere to go, and we need an alternative to that, I think, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, first of all, recognizing the history is so important, because, you know, one of the things I wanted to break through in the book, the lot of the historical stereotypes around poor white communities. You know, the one thing you see with the South Wales Valleys, for instance, you know, first of all, you know, they sent the largest delegation of volunteers to fight the fascists in the Spanish Civil War. So they all came from South Wales and Manning Valleys, right? There was a proud history of fighting historic fascism. Also, the wonderful connections they have with Paul Robeson, you know, and Paul Robeson builds up a real strong solidarity with the miners of, you know, the Truckee Male Voice Choir close to the town where I grew up, and has this remarkable kind of connection with Paul Robeson. And I think that history is important to remember, of course, those, you know, historical solidarities with the Black Civil Rights Movement and the workers' unions of South Wales. We're always historically embedded, and we can kind of forget that today. We kind of, in certain caricatures of poor white communities and this understanding. Now, your point then about, you know, the shift towards the far right. So, you know, what was interesting to me, you know, and I think it circles back to Ryan's point about kind of depression, first of all, as a social condition, a sense of hopelessness, a great deal of anger, a great deal of resentment, but not knowing where to direct that. Right? Where does that anger and resentment go? And I recall, you know, during the 1980s, there was the start in the South Wales Valleys of a few notable figures you would see where, you know, they would shave their heads, they'd be skinheads, and they'd start wearing, you know, the symbol of the NF, which was the National Front, which is the British fascist organization in the early 1980s. And you knew that, you know, again, I had a couple of friends who ended up becoming part of this kind of little cadre of, it was a very small group of people, but they were part of this cadre of people. And they were all very much linked to football hooligans in Cardiff City. So the football hooligans were very much, you know, linked to this emergence of a fascist politics then. But what was striking in the Welsh Valleys was that two of the kids, especially I knew, were actually sons of real strong militant leftist fathers who were almost like, you know, failed minor, you know, violent minors. And then the kids become violent, but they slip to the far right very quickly. And I think that in itself is a real kind of interesting and a dangerous understanding that you think about, you know. And I agree, you know, it's the same social dynamics which are now preyed upon whether it's in Trump's America or, you know, the ways in which political parties try to appeal to them in South Wales Valleys. It's the same in Germany. You know, the rise of the far right in Germany has also been taken root in these mining communities, which is, again, is historically is such a tragedy because those communities were the ones at the forefront of the fight against fascism historically. So I think that's, you know, that's a real tragedy, really.
Yeah, I was actually, you know, I was curious. Well, you know, while you we're talking just now, I looked up the presidential election results for McDowell County. And in 2008, it actually voted for Obama, 53-45. But then it shifted Republican. And by 2020, it was 79% voting for Trump versus just over 20% for Biden. Yeah, and that, you know, I feel like it's possible to overstate. You know, you don't want to imply that it's like the whole of Trumpism is things like McDowell County. Obviously, like Trump wins people who make more than $100,000, but it is a part of it. So that just incredible, huge swing in literally the poorest county in the entire country.
Well, yeah, there's something similar. You know, so in the United Kingdom, the communities which voted the highest for Brexit was the South Wales mining valleys. So yeah. They voted higher for Brexit. And I think, you know, I don't think in my own understanding, this wasn't about race or about immigration. This was, and again, to what Trump's been parasitic about, it played into the narrative that for them, Brexit was an elite project. And it was a middle-class concern. Europe is a middle-class concern. And for those communities, Europe didn't benefit. They didn't think there was, what was the, you know, so actually leaving was almost like a bloody nose to the middle classes who were constantly taking them for granted. And I think that is something we still need to come to terms with, that kind of sense of anger to the political classes, which Trump has been very parasitic upon. We know that, you know.
And both, obviously, the Rust Belt in the States and South Wales were, as you write, integral to globalization, yet didn't benefit from globalization, right? And as you say, literally didn't get to be global citizens in any sense, right? Of not even that. And so it's quite understandable to be resentful in that way. I think this is maybe an interesting time to bring in some of your good points about what you call the critiques of white privilege, or the kind of ways that, you know, talking about anti-colonialism or decolonization can be race essentialist and be part of the problem of forgetting about the problems of poverty and the kind of tragedy of globalization and capitalism, what it's done to these kinds of communities. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think it's helpful to understand what's gone on here and the kind of cultural and political formations that resulted, right? Is this forgetting, right?
Yeah, I think it's such an important question, because you know, as somebody who believes strongly in the absolute need for us, for instance, to decolonize the curriculum and to really rethink about, you know, the history of coloniality, I've always been a bit troubled by the ways in which there's this very reductive understanding of, for instance, you know, Europe is the colony and the rest of the world is colonized, right? Because I think it's much more complicated. And like I talk about in the book, you know, Wales was England's first colony, right? You know, a lot of the policies and punishments and systems were tested out in Wales as they were in Ireland before they were exported around the world. And I think that in itself becomes, you know, it reveals some of the complexities of coloniality. Now, you know, I had this moment when I was teaching there was all this debate around white privilege, and I was just uncomfortable with it in a sense where, you know, I just finished giving a lecture on Fanon, and I was saying to students, look, I'm just a bit uncomfortable with this term. I've just come back from the South Wales Valleys on a council estate, 3 generations unemployed. I think this language is going to be more alienating for these communities. You know, if you keep saying to these communities, you've got privilege, then, you know, it's absolutely cannon fodder for the far right, right? Another example of the intellectual classes claiming these people don't know. And I had a really lengthy conversation, and I published an interview with Vincent Brown from Harvard University on this, you know, and Vincent was saying the same, that he was sensing that there was an issue, for instance, with the Black Lives Matter movement, where, you know, it could have reached out to poor white Americans and say, look, you know what? we realize there's loads of you being shot by the police as well, right? You know, and I think that, you know, that there is something there. I think that I understand the racial lines of politics and we can't ignore those. But I do think sometimes some language is unhelpful in terms of reminding us of the past solidarity. I could never imagine Paul Robeson going to the South Wales Valleys and calling them privileged, right? I think there's lessons to understand there. Of course, like for me, I grew up in the South Wales Valleys. I'm an academic. I live an utterly privileged existence. I have no doubt about that. But I do think that, you know, we have to understand the ways in which there are a lot of white communities which have very little privilege. And I don't understand where that language helps in terms of building the very kinds of solidarities we need for the world right now.
And I think you even point out it's not even that race isn't involved because, you write about how the Welsh and many others considered white today were racialized and were, I mean, in a kind of racial hierarchy or a caste system themselves, and not considered as white or as worthy as others in the UK, right? Or like, so it's not even that it's like, it is insulting to say that they're privileged because they're white, but like there's also the problem of racism touching people considered white now as well in the history, and they're forgotten in how they've been neglected and shamed in those ways too, right?
Yeah, and that history is really, you know, it's an interesting history in the sense of, you know, you always think in the UK actually that it's the English versus the Welsh, the Scottish and the Irish, to give anybody like a geography lesson of the UK. But actually it's even more complicated than that because, you know, what you find historically is the English and the Scottish, if you ever try to study the history of the British kings and queens, it's all basically a battle between the English and the Scottish about who's going to dominate the throne. And those are people who are seen to basically come from, you know, the Anglo-Saxon stock, right? So they come from this Anglo-Saxon, whereas the Irish and the Welsh were seen to be descendants from the Celtic Silures tribes from the Mediterranean. So because they were darker skinned, darker haired, they were put down, and the anthropologists in the 19th century say they're closer to Africa. So there's this kind of Indianization, as they call it, of the Welsh and the Irish. So they become part of the same kind of racial hierarchical schematics, which has this real rich history. I remember like when I was growing up, you know, there was a lot of talk about white on white racism. We don't seem to talk about that so much today. And I think it's important not to forget about that, because I do think that it creates actually a richer conversation. You know, you can go to the South Wales Valleys and say, you know what? You can connect with these kids in America who are fighting for civil rights because they have this rich history that you have as well. And I think it's more enabling rather than actually saying, and, you know, I think part of the problem about contemporary politics today, it's really a fight about who suffers the most, who's the biggest victim of history. And I don't think suffering should never be a competition. It's not about that.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of solidarity that, right?
Yeah.
What, you know, I believe we referenced before Martin Luther King Jr., you know, his final sermon, you know, he talked about how whiteness in the South was very often a sort of just a psychic balm that was given in replacement, you know, as just a sort of meaningless trinket to poor white people.
The wages of whiteness.
Yeah. Right? That you all you get to do is feel better about other people for no reason, just because your skin happens to be a different color. We're not cutting you in on the money. We're not cutting you in on the good jobs. You just get to believe this completely nonsense lie. He talks about, you know, meeting with his jailers when he gets arrested for protesting. And when they tell him how much they make for money, he says, you guys ought to be out here marching with us. You know, you're just as poor as black people in the South. And all you are living on is the satisfaction of your skin being white and you thinking you're somebody big because you're white and you're so poor you can't send your children to school.
Absolutely. I get that. You know, I try to humor some of that narrative as well. You know, you grew up in the 1980s in the South Wales Valleys. But very few people were actually white. They were either pale, gray, blue kind of, or they were basically putting on fake suntan, and they looked at a bizarre kind of, well ahead of Donald Trump in this regard, you know, in terms of this kind of bizarre orangeness that, you know, and they used to put on this bizarre.
That's a new racial hierarchy. Orange is on top, apparently.
There's like orange, pale gray, like a, you know, yeah. So, yeah. over cold blue, and I guess there's very few actual white people.
Yeah. No, nobody's actually, I mean, very, very few. They were all pink, you know.
I like the one description of the socialization, the social reality and construction of race, at least in American politics, context in American politics, that said it wasn't that if you were black, you were put in the Jim Crow car. It's that if you were put in the Jim Crow car, that meant you were black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
I think that's I think it's and I think it's important for us to have these conversations while still being mindful that race matters, right? So it's not a case of saying, well, you know, race doesn't matter, but it's also just, as you say, to be appreciative of the rich history of coloniality, the ways in which there were those historical solidarities, and the ways in which certain essentializing terms just simply are marginalizing things. So.
Right. And if we could talk a bit more about the internal colony chapter, because not only is it a problem to not understand that complexity, but you understand something about imperialism and empire and the workings of power and how people are treated even within what might be considered the metropole or what have you, right? And what lessons can we learn from the history of South Wales about how kind of power functions today in ways that might be neglected, you think?
Yeah. Well, when I was writing the internal colony book, you know, it came from having read, you know, endless books on coloniality, and from, you know, Edward Galliano's work to Hannah Arendt's work to, you know, even like there's a wonderful collection of essays by there's another late Harvard historian, John Womack Jr., who wrote a book called Rebellion in Chiapas. And it was all basically the historical documents. And he shows, for instance, how colonization in Chiapas begins with, you know, the extraction of resources, right? It's all about, you know, rubber plantations and so on. And I think that, you know, that, and what Hannah Arendt says, you know, coloniality is expansion for expansion's sake. And we can't separate it from the history of capitalism. You know, it's intimately bound up to it. And I think there is something then worth reminding, you know, what I write about in the valleys is a paradigm which I call the coal colony. And I say that, you know, the coal colony is basically a model of ecological and human extraction. You know, so, and the colony itself is very much tied to this one mode of production. And, you know, for instance, you know, John Crichton Stewart, who was a Scottish aristocrat who owned the South Wales coal fields, would have had a wealth a third greater than what Bezos would have today, right? So that's the nature of his wealth, right? Now, if you go to Wales, for instance, you know, it's part of our national tourism today. We say, well, come to Wales and see the castles, right? We have more castles in Wales than anywhere else on the planet, right? There's a reason why you have so many castles, because you want to suppress a local population, right? So, you know, so the English built all these castles. But you go to Cardiff, which has perhaps the grandest castle of all in all of Wales. That was built in the 18th century for purely ceremonial purposes by John Crichton Stewart, just to say, I've got a castle, you know. And I think this is just a remarkable aspect of the ways in which you have that kind of aspect. Now, the one thing, of course, which I get the lesson from Wales as well is, coloniality is not just about saying, we're going to suppress you and we're going to destroy you. It learns to appropriate. It appropriates the energies and brings it into the colonial machine. You know, we see this plays out in Africa, you know, how we can absorb certain populations and you get them to fight for the cause. You give them a bit more promise than others. And that mentality of dividing and ruling. So coloniality in itself often speaks the language of progressivism. You know, it's very much about, yes, you know, we will help this population and we will, you know, you become part of the colonial machine. You know, the Romans did that wonderfully, right? The Romans understood that you get people absorbed into the system and you give them small benefits for being part of it. And in that sense, of course, people might say, well, didn't Wales benefit from the colonial system? Well, yes, parts of Wales certainly did benefit from it. But there's a great deal of parts of it which didn't, you know, and I think that it's to understand those, it's not just a one or nothing kind of situation. The coloniality works very much through appropriation and, you know, the Spinoza formula, you know, how do the masses learn to desire their oppression as though it was their liberation, right? And I think there is that sense in which, you know, that it works out very much clearly in England and South Wales. So.
I wonder, you talk about COVID a little bit as well, thinking about how we've left behind that the beating heart of empire and global capitalism used to be places like South Wales. But now when we picture the kind of extractive or exploitative, I mean, of course, there's still the Congo and all that. But when you think of, within the kind of metropoles, you think of Amazon workers not being able to urinate and driving, peeing in the bottle. And literally, I think the churn is so great that the turnover is you don't last 8 months in the job because there's injuries and it's just you're kind of almost not quite worked to death like you were in the coal mines, but a contemporary version. And then there's when you're thinking about the masculinity of the coal mines, there's the kind of beating heart today is a kind of feminine care economy almost. It's either the services or literally, especially during COVID, the care of the nurses, the care of people who are ill and vulnerable. What are the parallels and the lessons you see there about how these populations are being treated and how maybe neglected and forgotten and maybe abused in mm-hmm. kind of their own ways, do you think?
Yeah, I think, I absolutely agree with you in the sense of, part of the issue, again, with the valleys is the ways you take, for instance, again, back to depression. Depression in the valleys is always presented basically as a personal problem, even though you have half the population of some towns on antidepressants, right? So you present it as a personal problem rather than seeing it as a social problem. And I think, and I think actually what you do find then strangely is, the therapeutic model for governance on the South Wales valleys is almost like people are being cared to death, right? In a way where it's just, it's caring on the one hand without actually putting any financial investment into it, and it's a therapeutic model, which is right run on very short shoestring budgets, but also basically, is all about individual psychosis. So it's all about, the individual is the problem rather than the social being the problem. And, your point about COVID as well, and again, one of the, another of all the many tragic statistics of the South Wales Valleys, they're the highest rate of COVID deaths in the United Kingdom. Right? But it had everything to do with pre-existing conditions, everything to do with pre-existing conditions. And the fact that, I think what COVID revealed, and I think this was part of the problem I saw with the narratives of COVID, is this kind of, focusing on the exceptional, or, there's this guy who's an athlete who's dropped dead and whatever else, We know for the vast majority of COVID patients, they were pre-existing illnesses. And I think that in itself took away the necessary discussions of the links between poverty, ill health, and the ways in which this violence really revealed everything that was broken already about a society, I think.
As we close out, I have just maybe one kind of odd question for you. So, you talk about the geology of coal, as we mentioned before. And you mentioned the Carboniferous period, and I was doing a little side reading and learned that the Carboniferous and the Permian period, which was basically when all the coal deposits in the world were laid down, was only about 60 million years, in the lifespan of an Earth that's like 4.5 billion years old or whatever. So about 2% thereabouts of Earth's history is when all the coal came down. And apparently, geologists think that with some slight changes in evolution or some changes in just the background conditions of the time, there never would have been any coal at all. And so I wonder if you have any comments on the sort of like contingency of history and what might have happened to South Wales if there hadn't been any coal there.
I think it's really interesting. And I think we know history is utterly contingent and is utterly, and there's this moment actually I talk about in the opening chapter where the world was perilously close in this kind of the formation of the cold, what was called a global snowball event, where the entire Earth could have been potentially fully enclosed in ice and it would never have recovered, right? No life could have survived on there. And I think those utterly contingent moments, I just think when I go back historically now and I think about, the coal, and this is one of the things which I was also very keen to do was to kind of think about pre-colonial history and pre-colonial ideas. One of the things, if we connect this to the contemporary, political landscape, and back to your point, Alexis, about earlier about imagination, I think to me, the biggest crisis we face politically today is a crisis of the imagination. How do we imagine better futures? Which, of course, goes all the way back to your question, right, about how do we think about the past as well. What would have happened? What might have happened, right? And for me, one of the things I also tried to do in the book then is try to, you know, as you'll know, that I wrote a number of fables and ideas and try to be kind of lyrical with this. And it wasn't just because I was trying to go on some kind of flight of fancy, but for me, you know, there's a real rich history in Celtic traditions and cultures, which I think we've kind of forgotten about storytelling, about the use of fables, myths, fabulation. You know, I recovered this idea when I was, you know, in Chiapas with the Zapatistas, who used this kind of narrative and this kind of storytelling. And, you know, and to me, it was also important then to try to remember a lot of the myths and the stories and the things that I was learning in the valleys and readapt them slightly and put them into this book, because I do think, you know, how we kind of write the future and how we imagine the future and writing in a different way is also very important to those, you know, to rethink in those contingencies of history and say, well, you know, things were never inevitable really in the past. It's just a bit of luck. You know, how can we really rethink the future, mindful of the contingencies, but also maybe, you know, think about it in a more poetic way as well, rather than just simply saying we need to fall back upon technical solutions to the world. So
I love that. And if my last question, if you'll permit me, could go to some of that poetry, playing with the kind of the literal darkness and the metaphor of black and the kind of ways that you play with the idea of the void and how what is this nothingness we're talking about? What is this darkness? And of course, you're also suggesting that there's a kind of natality or a kind of becoming, an origin that can come from the void, that can spring from that. And there's something in the personal narrative as well as the kind of philosophical meditations, I think, that is worth maybe ending on here, because even though we're not romanticizing the struggle and the suffering personally or historically, there is something you think that can be gleaned for that kind of imagining you were just talking about.
Yeah. Right? Well, maybe I can end on a bit of a mediation on the book's cover, you know, which was painted by my, you know, my brilliant wife, the artist Chantal Mezzer. Right? So she does this wonderful cover. And for me, the cover really captures this, as you say, that void that, you know, and I always wonder about, I think about the valley itself as a place, but also the valley as a time, the valley as a wound, you know, literally a wound in the earth. The valley is a psychosis. And I think there is something, you know, in that blackness. And it's interesting the other day because of some of the reactions I've already had to the book, you know, some people very praising of it, others kind of utterly kind of, you know, concerned. Oh, you know, this is too pessimistic. And, you know, and I was looking at the book itself and, you know, it was just sat on a table. And I thought, you know, it delightfully looks like a crack, you know, and it's actually, it reveals this crack. And I think this question around the void is so important because, you know, if we think about the void as it's nothing, but it's everything, right? And without being a contradiction, you know, that it's a site, it can be an utter abyss, but it could be a site of pure potentiality as well, you know? And I think in that sense, you know, we think about the black, you know, the writer of the book's called How Black Was My Valley. Black is the sum of all color, right? It's not the absence of color. And I think in that, if we think about it in those terms, you know, that there is that kind of, you know, that space, that opening, that cut in the earth, which still, you know, the future's never always, never written. And I think there's something in that, in the color black itself, which I still find myself utterly drawn to, you know, and I always wear because I'm utterly funereal in my kind of appearance. But that's another valley thing. So, yeah.
Wonderful.
Great.
Well, thank you, Brad.
No, thanks so much, guys. And it's always a pleasure to join you and chat about these things. So.
Absolutely.
Brad Evans, the book is called How Black Was My Valley? Poverty and Abandonment in a Post-Industrial Heartland. We will link to it in the show notes. Thanks for coming on, Brad.
Always a pleasure, guys.
And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you in the next episode.